This episode of the Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico podcast is brought to you by Spectacle Eyewear. Now, if you've been watching any episodes of this podcast on our YouTube channel, you might have noticed I've been wearing some pretty cool specs lately. Well, you know where I get them? Spectacle Eyewear, 505 Tremont Street, Boston, Massachusetts. Their phone number is 617-542-9600. Head down to Spectacle. Go visit our friend Paul. You'll get yourself some cool specs. Hello, my fellow rock and roll fans. Please consider supporting this podcast for as little as $1 a month at patreon.com/TwistedRico. Once again, that's patreon.com/TwistedRico. Keep the rock and roll alive. Welcome to Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. We have a very, very special show for you today. One of the great and most influential American musicians of our time, Roger Miller, guitarist of Mission of Burma, joins us today. You just heard This Is Not a Photograph from the Mission of Burma Signals, Calls, and Marches EP, which was released in 1981 on Ace of Hearts Records. It's a record that Pitchfork calls the 53rd best record of the 80s. I think we might have it a little higher on our list. Not too long ago, we had Mission of Burma drummer Peter Prescott on the show for an exceptional interview. And today, it's guitarist Roger Miller's turn to tell his story, which I think you will find very interesting. Stick around and we'll be right back. Being the big vinyl lover that I am, I'm proud to tell you about Joe's Albums in their two locations. The original shop at 317 Main Street in downtown Worcester, Massachusetts, and their second location out in Western Mass at 5 Market Street, North Hampton. Both of these shops are loaded with both new and used vinyl. It's hard to walk in either shop and walk out empty-handed due to their amazing collection of records and other cool goodies like t-shirts, mugs, posters, etc. If you can't find what you're looking for in the retail stores, check out their website, joesalbums.com. Thank you, Joe, for being so cool. Okay, and we're back. You know, when Peter Prescott was on the show in December, we talked about Mission of Burma's early beginnings and how he ended up playing with Clint Connolly, Roger Miller, and Martin Swope. Today, we hear about Roger's early days in Ann Arbor, Michigan, and how he moved to Boston, met Clint, and they first formed the band Moving Parts, and then later recruited Peter Prescott to form what turned into one of America's most influential bands to emerge from the 1980s independent music scene. That scene in the 80s was incredible. When you think about the amount of amazing records that came from independent labels that time, it's astonishing. Of course, much of this is based on opinion, but personally, I would single out some of these albums as those kind of influential records I speak of. Black Flag Damage, which is on SST. The Minutemen, Double Nickels on the Dime, also SST. The Replacements, Let It Be on Twin Tone. Husker Du, Zen Arcade, SST again. The Violent Femmes' first album on Slash. Minor Threat, Out of Step on the Discord label. Circle Jerks, Group Sex on Frontier, The Descendants and Joy on Restless Enigma, of course, X Los Angeles, and we can't forget those first two Dinosaur Jr. records. And then, of course, there's Mission of Burma's Versus album. Mark Deming at AllMusic summed it up pretty good. The EP Singles, Calls, and Marches suggested that Mission of Burma had the talent and vision to become one of America's great rock bands. The subsequent album Versus proved beyond a doubt that the band had arrived and was fully realizing its potential. I would totally agree with that statement wholeheartedly. And I would also like to say that Versus contain my favorite Mission of Burma song, That's How I Escaped My Certain Fate, and many other great songs. Mission of Burma was an inspiration to so many in their early split in 1983 before they eventually returned 20 years later was premature, but it was necessary for a number of reasons, which Roger talks about in an interview. It was an honor to talk with Roger Miller, and here is our conversation for your listening pleasure. Welcome to those of you watching on YouTube. This is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. If you want to hear this entire show with intros, outros, and music, please go to Apple, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Amazon Music, etc. Please welcome to the show, Roger Miller.
Be like this or something, right?
It's an honor to have you on the show, and we just kind of like touched on something right before I turned the record button on. Could you tell us what it was like growing up in Ann Arbor, which is kind of like an extension to Detroit? Well, it's at least as far as the music goes, it had to have some sort of a impact on you.
Well, quite, yes. I mean, to get put it all in context, I was in sixth grade when the Beatles played Ed Sullivan Show. So before sixth grade, I was just a kid that did stuff, ran around, climbed trees, rode my bike. After the Beatles, I was a rocker. Literally the next day, I bought the first Beatles album, Meet the Beatles, and I've been a rocker ever since, and that was quite a while ago. Pretty good radio, CKLW, Keener 13, and WITSY, WXYZ, all came out of Detroit, the Canadian city right across the way, Windsor, Ontario. And we're just, me and Larry and Ben, my brothers, we're just glued to the radio. Like when, I remember when You Really Got Me came out, which was shortly, within a half year of the Beatles. And you heard that guitar solo, just this manic 10 seconds of guitar solo. And before that, Ray goes, and Dave starts yelling, and then you hear that 10 seconds. I was just riveted, And so we started playing guitar, and then by ninth grade, the psychedelia had kicked in. And when I was in ninth grade and Larry and Ben were in seventh grade, there's a lot of guitarists in my house. Like friends would come over and play guitar, and I saw all these guitars. I said, we need to make a band. So I have a pretty good organizational skill set. And so I put a band together. It's called the Sky High Purple Band. I believe I can be forgiven since I was in ninth grade, and it was the Summer of Love, 1967. But we did, Yardbirds, Kinks, 13th Floor Elevators, Stones, Music Machine, all that kind of shit.
So you were about 13 when you picked up the guitar?
Yeah, 12, 13. And that band I was talking about, Sky High, I was 15 when that started. And we're doing Shapes of Things by the Yardbirds, Splash One by the Elevators, but
What
totally.
kind of gigs? What kind of gigs did you play?
Well, I mean, literally, we're in junior high school, so we played at a friend's, Greg Getz's Psychedelic Garage, as our friend, and we're called the Sky High Purple Band, so he had Sky High Purple Drink. It was purple Kool-Aid. But, and we had two guitars and the voice all coming through one small Univox amp. And I played bass, and we had a drummer. And then we played in another friend's attic later that summer. And then when I was in high school, it wasn't cool playing with your brothers in eighth grade, So that changed. But summer of 67, that was like the first love-ins. They were a mile away from our parents' house. We just walked down to West Park. The very first one was Grateful Dead, Charles Lloyd Quartet, and the Seventh Seal, which is Bill Kirchen, who was in Commander Cody, and his brother later played in Sprott and Lair. So we were there at the beginning of all that stuff, and we saw the MC5 like 10, 15 times because they played concerts. So
Yeah, so I was going to ask you about Mitch Ryder and all the Detroit bands. Did you start listening to them when you were younger?
whatever was on the radio, I mean, I bought Questmark 45s when they came out. I never bought any Detroit Wheels, but I love like Breakout. God, it just, it was it, I was in ninth grade. I was the target audience. We got to break out now. We got to break out. Or it was just as good as Break On Through to the Other Side by the Doors. And both of them felt the same kind of to me, like, yeah, it's time to do that shit. I still feel like that today. It's like, God, we got to break out of this shit.
If you're watching on YouTube, you can see the Sproton Layer t-shirt that Roger's wearing, which is surprised me because I was going to ask you about them and you have the shirt on. So that was with your brothers, Ben and Larry, right?
Yeah, that's a little further down the road. But, growing up, hitting ninth grade and the Summer of Love in through my high school ended in June 1970. So that was like the heyday of psychedelia, and Ann Arbor was one of the places where you could see that happening. This Iggy Pop went to my high school. I was never in the same class. He was older than me. But, in the MC5 and all that, John Sinclair, we would go by the Hill Street House. I later had a girlfriend in 71, 72, and we'd go to meetings at the, I think they were called the Rainbow People by then, which was too bad. White Panthers was a little
What a
gunnier.
place to grow up. Wow, I've been to Detroit many times and I love that area. The music that has been coming there from years. My friend, and you probably know him, Alvin Long, is just one of many people that moved to Boston from Detroit. There seems to be quite a few Detroit people. When you were in Ann Arbor, it was like a pretty much a college town area. Did you think that had a lot to do with what was going on there musically?
Yeah, well, there's two things that are a plus about a college town. One, it tends to be more liberal than a non-college town, because just the nature of colleges is you're trying to expand your mind, usually. And it had lots of youth. Like the University of Michigan was big, so it had lots of young people, and young people generally want to break out, to quote Mitch Ryder. So it was a perfect. The perfect storm. Like, and I just rode through it, taking psychedelics, smoking pot, and the whole psychedelic revolution. And in those days, anything could happen. Like the first Silver Apples album, how the hell did that get put out? It was great. Soft Machine, early Pink Floyd. We got turned on to Captain Beefheart in Strictly Personal era, which is before Trout Mask. And at the same time, even the Doors, like you can badmouth them all you want, But I saw them just before their second album came out with The Crazy World of Arthur Brown opening up for them. Fucking incredible show. Both Arthur Brown was amazing, and then The Doors were even more amazing, which is hard for me to say that with a straight face, but it was the theater and the musicianship. It was just really, of course, I was only in 10th grade, so maybe I was.
Were your parents really supportive of you and your brother's love for music at the time?
My dad had played piano in college. Like, I have a little silver cup that he won, the best piano player for 3 or 4 years. He was thinking of becoming a classical pianist. You know, when I was growing up, he would play Chopin and Beethoven. He prefers the romantics to the classical, but he was always playing that stuff when we were going to sleep. He put on, you know, Saint-Saëns or César Franck or Mozart. And so he was very interested that we were doing this. My mom's She said that she didn't think music was a valid career. She was a scientist through and through. But the thing that my dad did, really to his credit, was when he heard that we're listening to like Saucer Full of Secrets, you know, that side, it's there was collage, sound, tape modification. He said, you know, why don't you go? This was fall 68. Why don't you go? There's this thing at the University of Michigan called Contemporary Directions, which is they're playing the newest music, you know, Penderecki, Stockhausen. We saw In C by Terry Riley there before I had any idea who Terry Riley was. And so we'd see, this is a cliche thing I say all the time, but it's true. We'd go to the free concert Sunday afternoon, get high, listen to the MC5 or whoever was playing, and then that night get high and go to Contemporary Directions and hear Stockhausen and, you know, Terry Riley. So those things didn't seem that different to us. I think all three of us were like that.
Your brothers ended up forming Destroy All Monsters. Was that, I know you went to school in California. I was going to ask you about that. Did they form that band before you left or when you were gone or?
It needs a little clarification. They did not form the band. It was Carrie Lorne and Niagara with those two very famous artists, Jim Shaw and Mike Kelly. But their very first gig, which is 73 going into 74, there was a New Year's Eve party at this comic book convention. And someone told me there was, you know, it was the happening scene. So I was there. And then they needed another musician. And I told Gary, you know, I can play guitar. And in true punk fashion, he said, no, you're too good on guitar. I'll play drums. And he go, okay. So I played drums and we did like Iron Man and Waiting for the Man. That's what I remember, anyways. So Carrie already had this band, and then in 77, Jim and Mike had left, and he was trying to put a real band together. And my brother's it was Larry, my brother Lawrence's band, M Pool, which was a very free form noise band, with a keyboardist, Andre Sinkin, and Larry played guitar, just lots of effects, and just literally a noise band before the term noise band existed. Carrie wanted A friend of mine, Paul Kasdan, brought Carrie over and he said, yeah, why don't you guys join the band? And they needed a drummer, somebody to hold it down. So I and my brother Ben alternated playing drums. We played one show and then they got a real drummer. So I switched to playing bass. And Larry and Ben joined the band and the electronics kind of went out the window and it became a rock band. And then once they got a real bass player, I did lights until I moved to Boston because it wasn't really the band for me. You know, like I couldn't imagine Niagara singing In the Sun by Sprott and Lair. You know, if you can't
Right.
sing by Sprott and Lair, what are you talking to me for?
You went to California before Boston, right? Didn't you go to school in California?
Yeah, so before that, yes, in 76, I went to CalArts. And I dropped out really quickly because I didn't like, what's the point of academia? You know, am I going to become part of an institution? And I preferred something more street level, and it was a confusing time. I didn't know what I was doing, but it was helpful to me. I learned how to compose better there, developed some of my surrealist ideas. Then I came back to Boston. That in 77, punk broke, and I had a band called Red Ants that went through a bunch of mutations and never accomplished anything whatsoever. I developed tinnitus during that time.
So you went from Michigan to California to Boston in that order?
I went back. California was only like spring and early summer of 76. And then I moved back to Boston. And then it was kind of confused. And then 77 punk hit. And it turned out that the Monsters was the happening thing, you know. And I supported it whenever I could because it was the happening thing. It was like exciting. The times were just so exciting. But I developed tinnitus, so I just said, well, you know, I didn't want to be in Destroy All Monsters, and Ann Arbor wasn't doing it for me, and Ann Arbor didn't want me. Thank goodness. Ann Arbor almost did it, kicked me out intentionally. If
What
you can read that into a overt.
made you go to Boston?
Larry and Ben had been there before, and they had attended a piano technician school. I thought, well, screw this. I don't like academia. I'm not going to make it as a rock musician because I have tinnitus. So I'm going to learn a useful skill that has to do with my instrument. So I came to Boston to be a piano technician
You
in
did.
early 78. And within a week, I knew that Boston was pretty different than Ann Arbor. Like you'd see like punk posters and you know they had mass art. There's all these colleges in Boston, and because of that there was a lot more energy and the so much of a bigger place. And then I saw this advertisement saying this band needed a bass player that could read music. You know, I just graduated, you know, just dropped out of music school and liked punk rock. So I called them up and I said, "Do you need a bass player?" And they go, "No, that's an old ad. We need a guitarist." And I said, "Okay, I'll be a guitarist." Because I knew that this was my last chance to do what I felt was my destiny. You know, I don't want to be too profound there, but I knew that I had something to do with rock that, and I hadn't done it yet. So damn the tinnitus, full speed ahead. That band became Moving Parts. I barely won the audition because I wasn't that good of a guitarist yet, and but I was a good songwriter, and
And that
so.
was with Clint, Eric Lindgren, and Bobby Bear on drums, the late Bobby Bear.
Amazing guy.
Do you remember when you first started playing out with them and where you guys played?
Oh yeah. I mean, I joined the band I think in February or March, and I immediately brought in songs. Like I just started writing, so it was half my songs, half Eric's. And my songs were a little more physical, Eric's were a little more analytical. But you know, they worked together in that band. Our first gig was in June, I'm pretty sure at Cantones, probably with the Malls, which was also another kind of a prog-ish rock, post-punk, or I don't know if it was post-punk yet, I can't remember. When is the timeline? But interesting that band had Peter Prescott on drums.
Yeah.
And then we played with Human Sexual Response, you know, DMZ. But we only lasted from June till December because by, like I hit it off with Clint immediately. You know, the cliche is, and it's true, when I went in for an audition, I opened the door and the Ramones were on the turntable. And I started doing this funny dance, and Clint came around the corner from the kitchen doing the same dance. And we hadn't agreed, you know, it wasn't a dance that other people did. It was weird doing the same dance. And we were doing the same dance. You know, like we really got along well. As time went on, conflicts with Eric's more analytical approach, and Clint and I wanted a guttier approach. And so the band broke up in December. And me and Clint agreed that we were going to form a new band after that. And that was Mission of Burma.
Before, okay, that's it. We're done. No, I'm just kidding. Before we talk about Burma, did you form Bird Songs with Eric, Bird Songs of the Mesozoic simultaneously, or did that come a lot later? Because I was under the impression that you had both bands at the same time.
I have to talk about Burma first before that, because I was still living in the house with Eric, and Eric was pretty pissed off that it wasn't entirely me, but I kind of led the thing saying this band can't continue. I'm going to form a new band. I'm quitting Moving Parts, and that broke the band up. And Eric was not happy. And we lived in the same house, and we had passed by each other, and it was just like ice. It was not good. And the story gets resolved shortly thereafter. But that's where it was at the beginning. And when Moving Parts started rehearsing, we rehearsed in that place, and Eric had to listen, Mission of Burma, I mean, Eric had to listen to Mission of Burma, you know, the band that should have been his band, Moving Parts. And he was pissed off. And then he went and saw Mission of Burma after like our third or fourth gig, and he got it. And he came up to me and he said, "You know, Roger, you are right. Mission of Burma is the band for you guys." And it was a resolution. To his credit, he said that to me. You know, I didn't force him to say it. I didn't tell him to go to hell. I was just like, you know. And then he came to me saying that, and I said, "Well, that's, you know, I mean, I can't remember what I said at the time, but it felt good because I don't really like tension with people, particularly if you're living in the same house." And there was a piano there that I was working on, kind of repairing for him. And I started writing these piano pieces that became Birdsong for the Mesozoic. And he heard me writing these piano, he heard me playing these piano pieces.
Yeah.
And he said, "Wow, Rod, I have a studio. Why don't you just come and record those in my studio?" I mean, for, you know, I broke up his band, and yet he was magnanimous afterwards. So I got to give him a lot of credit, and he got the payback from it. But, you know, so I went to his studio, and he had kind of a chinky piano, but he played synthesizer. We used a rhythm machine, and I had Martin play some guitar, and those were a version of Sound Valentine, and then Pulse Piece, which came out of the Modern Method compilation album. And that was the beginning of Birdsongs of the Mesozoic. And then, so that was 1980. That was like Academy Five Song had just come out, and Birdsongs of the Mesozoic started. And I think our first show was in 81 when the Modern Method sampler came out and Pulse Piece was on it. And I put a show together with me and Eric, Rick Scott, Martin Swope, also in the band, two bands at the same time. And I had my friend Steve Stain, who did a lot of avant-garde stuff, really great for speaking in tongues. He did excellent speaking in tongues. David Hild from the Girls and Peter Prescott all playing percussion. And Steve was whipping a chain against a metal can. And so we only did three tunes, but it was, you know, chaotic, and it was kind of cool. And then Rick Hart saw that and said, "Well, why don't we make a record of that stuff?" So that, while Burma was going, that was going too.
Yeah, simultaneously. I wanted to ask you something about, you said you played with the Malls and you met Peter. When did you and Clint realize that Peter was going to be the guy that you wanted to play with? Did you figure that out early on?
It took us a while. We auditioned a lot of drummers. We actually auditioned him twice, maybe even three times. The first time Clint liked him, the second time I liked him and Clint didn't. And then the third time we both go, you know, "Fuck, man, let's go. Let's do it." We auditioned just amazingly bad drummers, and some that were good, but they weren't appropriate. I remember this one guy from Berkeley. He was like a classic, the negative archetype of a Berkeley guy. And we're doing the song Max Ernst, which has, you know, pretty rock solid for it. And then it has these accents. Bam, 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 da 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 da, chan, chan, chan. They're all offbeats. And this fucking drummer, during the entire verses, he was just showing off, like doing all these fills, but he couldn't get those accents. He would come to him and he'd throw his sticks down and go, "What the fuck? I can't do it. What's wrong?" And then he'd try again. And it was like, "Out of my basement, motherfucker. You know, who the fuck do you think you are?" Anyway.
And so then you said that, so you guys said Peter's the guy.
And Peter actually, I his girlfriend at the time, Diane, who I'm still friendly with, she said that he went home and practiced that riff really hard to get those accents, and he came in and he knew it. And it's like, great. That's all we ask is that you learn these riffs. And then once he learned the riffs, he brought in a lot of his own ideas. Like his drumming style is really pretty unique, you know. You know, like shit like Fun World, which you could go, you could be playing a rock beat for, but he just followed the guitar part on the tom-toms in the similar way that my brother Lawrence would play in Sprott and Lair. He would follow the riffs in a non-traditional way. And that's what made Peter's drumming so cool.
Do you remember some of the earliest Mission of Burma shows and what they were like. And did you already know Rick Hart at that time, or did he come and see you guys at a show?
The moving parts were already on his radar. He really liked, we would close with Max Ernst because that was our strongest. So, you know, it was like rock and da-da, and then we didn't have the tape loops yet, but it was, you know, you get in chaos and you leave the stage holding your guitar up or whatever it is, whatever rituals people bonded with. And Rickard was very interested, and he knew that we were forming a new band, so he actually came and saw a rehearsal of us in the basement in Waldo Terrace in Brighton Center. Came to a rehearsal and evinced interest in the band, particularly the song Max Ernst, which later became the B-side in Academy.
First single.
Was the actual A-side. Max Ernst was now a level B rather than a level A, which means that the band was really much better, because what before was level A is now level B, which means that we're going to go much farther than we would have before.
So do you remember like some of the early gigs and then what led up to you guys recording Academy Fight Song and Max Ernst?
I mean, I remember our first show was on April Fool's Day. Lou Miami was a really interesting character on the scene. He called them Lou Miami Transfusions, and it was all new bands. Like that night, there were seven new bands. Like every month, there'd be seven new bands. This was 79, the energy was really high. And we're just still doing a lot of moving parts songs, but I remember my friend Eric Van, who's kind of a legend also in his own way, said that the minute I came on stage and just fiddled around with the guitar, did a little bit of feedback, you could tell it was a completely different category of everybody else that had come before. It was like, this was the next level up. And we weren't always that great really early on. We hadn't quite figured out how to be who we were. And I didn't really get, you know, even on Signals, Calls, and Marches, I don't think I was that good of a guitar player. I was unusual. But what I thought I was doing at the time, I wasn't. I was projecting into the future. By the time we got to verses, I had my style, which nobody else had. So, you know, that made me valuable.
And and Rick was watching everything closely at that time.
Yeah, he would come to a lot of the shows, and he kind of worked with us. Like right away, he glommed onto us, and we're like, why is this guy doing this? And he's, you know, he's a bona fide eccentric. Like some people try to be eccentric, Rick's the real thing. And he's, you know, and I love Rick. I'm still really good friends with him. You know, he believed in all that stuff. It was really great. You know, our early shows were pretty uneven. In fact, a lot of our shows were uneven, according to people in history. And when we'd play outside of Boston, you know, we were the hot new band when Academy Fight Song came out. And so they'd have us in the suburbs of Boston, and there'd be like literally like five people, nobody there. One club was their first night, and after they had us at the opening night, they closed because nobody came. That's how I remember it. It may not be completely accurate. But we felt like we're doing stuff, and people around us knew that there was something there, even when there was hardly anybody in the audience. There was something going on, and it proved to be correct. You know?
Now, you mentioned Martin Swope earlier. I mean, did he kind of inject himself into all of this, or did you guys think like, okay, we got to get this guy to do his thing with us? How did he become part of Burma?
My brother Ben moved to Boston also to become a piano tuner, kind of following my footsteps. He lived in the same house, and Martin moved out to play music with him. And my brother Ben had taught Martin how to read music, more or less. And then Ben moved back to Ann Arbor, and Martin was just sitting in Boston going, what the fuck? And so Martin had a tape recorder, and he was doing those, you know, Eno, Frippin' Eno was a big deal. And so he would do those kind of things, and we would do, I had a piano piece that he looped, and then he put guitar loops on it. It was just experiments. And then I had the song New Disco, which is the first song with loops, and there's very few lyrics. I think there's five lyrics. I'm so tired. The lyrics are, I'm so tired of your personal grudge. When you come around, my mouth will be a den of vipers. And so first I go, I'm so tired. And he would loop that. And then he would loop it so all five of those phrases were going around in a demonic cacophony. That was my idea. I said, Martin, I asked everybody in the band, let's try Martin on this and see if it worked. Because he and I had done a little bit of work and it really worked. So eventually he started just doing, sometimes we would have ideas what him to do, and sometimes he would come up with his own ideas. He wouldn't rehearse with us. He'd do his experiments live, which probably helped the chaos and mixed bag of our shows. And by the time we did Signals, Calls, and Marches, he appeared on the album cover.
Did you guys tour much out of New England after that? After Signals, Calls, and Marches?
Yeah, even Academy Fight Song before Signals, we did a Midwest tour. It was mostly baffled audiences. I remember we played Minneapolis. Husker Du opened up for us.
Wow.
Record yet? They were the equivalent of us a year earlier. I remember them doing the song Diane. Really impressed me. But anyways, the paper there said, there's Mission to Burma. They can't tell whether they're a pop band or an art band. Like Academy Fight Song, Max Ernst. Well, that's the problem. By the time we got to Versus, we had it all merged together. This is like who we are. If you find that to be a problem, then don't listen to us. I don't give a shit.
I had Greg Norton on the show not too long ago. He's an interesting guy. It's kind of a weird similarity when you think about it, because they had two songwriters like you guys. It was an interesting match. Versus seemed to be when everyone all of a sudden was like, even though That's When I Reached for My Revolver was kind of a hit, it didn't reach the level until years later. You also were involved with Dread Fool in the Din with the rest of Burma. What was it? That must have been a fun experience for you.
Oh, it was great. Michael Hafitz, who managed us Burma very briefly early on, he knew Dan Ireton. And Dan Ireton was a friend of ours. He was like a fan of Moving Parts. He and his wife, Pat, would come see Moving Parts. And then they came to see Burma. So they were like original fans. And Michael Hafitz said, we've got the studio situation. You guys want to come in and record his songs? I'd been in the studio twice in my life by then, maybe three times. So sure, this is going to be fun. It was super minimal. And again, you didn't want me on guitar because I was too good. So I played Farfisa, which I'm also good at, but I played really, really minimally. I qualify as a very good keyboard player, but I did real minimal, as if I was in the Velvets. Clint played guitar. Pete forgot to bring some of his stuff. So all he had was a tom-tom. Perfect. And Martin played bass, but was like, I believe, piano hammer, just kind of hammering on it. And Dredd would just, Dan would wail away. It was completely fun. We thought of it as basically a lark. And I think those, they, Dreadful in the Din opened up for Burma at the Channel once. And we opened up with We Will Fall by the Stooges. Da, 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 da. And so the drone was starting. And me and Clint, when Dredd came on stage with kind of a cape, me and Clint were on our knees bowing down to him. And it was mystical fun. It was like Tyrannosaurus Rex or something.
One thing I learned from you already in this conversation is you said you had tinnitus long before I thought you got it. I was going to ask you when the problem really started becoming an issue.
It happened when I was playing in one of my incarnations of Red Ants in 77 in Ann Arbor. And we played really, really loud. And I was just stupid. The band wasn't very good. And I got tinnitus. And so I said, so that's when I stopped playing rock music the first time. And then the tinnitus disappeared. I mean, and I thought, well, this is great. And then I went to see Destroy All Monsters, and the next day I had tinnitus again. And so I said, well, screw that. I want to be able to hear when I'm 50. I'm now 72 and I'm talking to you.
And you can hear.
incredibly good lip reader. And so I had tinnitus then. It wasn't, compared to what it is now, it's nothing. But and that's why when I moved to Boston, I'm, piano technician. But when I saw, the options here, I go, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead. This is, if I don't do this, I'll regret it for the rest of my life. And I
I
did.
was I was at the matinee show at the Bradford Hotel, which is very well documented. How were you feeling that day? And when you see the footage now, how do you feel about that? Because there's so much footage about that show. Everyone talks about the Bradford Hotel show. What was your whole, how do you look at that now, basically, from when it was back then?
Well, the real problem, it actually it came out better. I've seen footage of it since, and it's better than I remember it being. And the reason is that, we used to play all the time. Like, we'd play seven shows a month, and it was just, we were always playing. And Clint, he went to dry out just before that show for being an alcoholic. And to his credit, he has kept sober, and he still knows how to rock. Fuck him. And so we didn't rehearse at all for 3 weeks. And when we started playing, I go, God, some of the muscle memory was gone. I really felt kind of like, God, while we were playing, I wish we had rehearsed a little bit better. But then someone played for me recently, The Fun World Into Something Else. He showed it at the Brattle Theater in Boston. And I was like, wow, that's not as bad as I remember it. We tend to be critical. I remember mostly just the idiotic things about Burma. Like, we were in San Francisco and our hosts were giving us cocaine all day. I don't really like cocaine that much, but it was kind of fun. They were just driving us around town. We're listening to P-Funk all nonstop, Parliament, P-Funk. And then we got to playing. I was so high that I would start singing and I would hit a note that was two notes higher. I was like, what the fuck? Just stupid shit like that. That's the stuff I remember, just the idiotic shit. And really, a lot of it was.
I was pretty young when I went to that show, and I'll never forget. It seemed like you guys were able to bridge the art scene and the hardcore scene together very well at that time. And I thought that show was the perfect example with the Dangerous Birds and then Negative FX and then you guys. How do you think you guys were able to fit in so well with the hardcore crowd that they liked you?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we really had a kind of a punk rock energy, no matter how arty we were, with funny time signatures. I mean, even Clint wrote in funny time signatures and did weird detuning. So it isn't just me, just saying this. We managed to make things really physical. And I think that's our virtue, is that merging the intellectual and the physical together was not really done that much. And we do miss the thing that we're missing is, and that's why we didn't get more popular, is the fuzzy, warm, emotional stuff in the middle. I mean, there's a lot of emotions in our stuff, but it's usually like yelling and screaming and occasionally apologizing and then cursing someone. It's not like there's not much warm, fuzzy stuff in our music. You have the intellectual and the physical, and this kind of missing that middle section. But I think that's why the hardcore scene. And we played fast. We played
Oh yeah.
fast, really.
Ace of Hearts released the Horrible Truth About Burma live record in 1985. It's still a really popular record. How did you feel when the band had disbanded and that record came out? Did it make you feel like, wow, we should have kept going? I mean, did you have any thoughts about that?
Yeah, I didn't care much about it at the time, to be honest. It didn't I didn't like Heart of Darkness. It was okay. It didn't do much to me. But I mean, I was glad it got put out. I'm like, okay, great. Awesome. And they used that photograph that I took on the cover, which it was just such a trashy photograph. It was with an $8 camera that was all warped around the edges, so it was pr a perfect
Love that cover.
It was pretty funny. But yeah, it didn't do a lot for me, or wasn't neither I didn't care much about it.
You'd moved on by that point, pretty much, right?
Yeah, and I mean, there's definitely good moments on it, I guess.
That's how I escaped my certain fate.
Is that on there? Literally, I don't think I've ever listened to it.
Aside from bird songs, you released a ton of solo records on SST, New Alliance, and other label. It seemed like you never really stopped working at that time. You did you ever take a break?
It depends how you look at it. It's just that was my job, you know. It's like people go to, you know, people at McDonald's. You mean you worked all day today? You didn't take a break? Well, they had to. It's like it's just what I did. I created music all the time. You know, and I was, you know, fairly broke during a lot of it because all I did was make music. And I still, that's all I do. Now I'm, you know, because I do soundtrack work and I teach guitar lessons and my status has risen a little bit. I can make a living, you know, but it's just, yeah. I mean, I would always have ideas. And my brothers are like this too. They constantly generate ideas. And every year they're doing two or three different things, just like me. It's just something genetic.
And then, you know, the Alloy Orchestra, Binary System, many other projects. You were just totally busy the whole time with your job, as you call it.
Yeah, the thing that really, when Burma reformed, I was in Alloy Orchestra also, and it was occasionally trouble. Like, you know, they would be booked and they would be booked, and how are we going to integrate this? And I remember one time, Burma had played Altamont parties in the southern part of England. The Burma set was 10 to 11 o'clock, and at 11 o'clock, I gathered all my stuff up, and at midnight, a cab came to pick me up, took me to the bus station. I had a flask of whiskey and orange juice, my preference at the moment. And the bus took me to the train station. The train station was supposed to take me into London, then back to the airport. And I begged the guy, "We're right at the airport. Please let me off." And he was kind of pissed, but he let me off. So then I got an hour of sleep there, flew to Cork, got an hour of sleep in that airport, flew to Boston, got an hour of sleep on the plane, took the train to the upper end of Boston, to the train to Manchester, New Hampshire. There was a car waiting for me, and I made sound check in Manchester, New Hampshire with Alloy Orchestra. Like with 3 hours of sleep, it was like, and less than, and I could do it. I don't know why the fuck I could do it. But yeah, it was kind of insanity, but it was so insane that it was kind of fun. It was like, I never knew kind of where I was. You know, I was just floating in space, and I was making a living just by being, you know, a spaced out musician.
That's dedication too, going on a trip like that.
That was the most insane one. And it worked, you know, and it was like seven steps or nine steps, and all of them were, and I showed up just right on time for soundcheck. Those guys looked at me, there he is.
Before that, in May 2000, you and Clint joined the peer group on stage. And some people say it was planned as the beginning of, let's say, an unofficial reformation of the band. Was that the case, or is it just a fun thing that you guys were doing?
Clint played with them for a while. I think it was more like a hint that from our unconscious that we're getting close to doing something, but none of us thought of it that way. But yeah, Clint was playing bass with them. And so they were opening for Wire, and I wanted to see Wire. So I said, "Pete, do you need an organ player, a cornet player?" He goes, "Sure." So I got to see Wire for free. But we'll play whatever Mini Beast plays, and I'm in the area, I play cornet, but I just show up with my cornet because it's so much fun playing with. So that's a bit of a joke. But yeah, so we opened up for Wire, Pete's band, with me and Clint in it, and then I talked to Wire afterwards. So like that right there, Mission of Burma and Wire is like, it's kind of a psychic optimism predicting the future, but there was no consciousness of it. We had no.
The band, you know, you guys reformed, you put out some incredible records. I got to see you guys a couple times during that period, and I love all those records. Was Matador like right immediately sitting on the doorstep waiting for you guys at that time? Because they had done some reissues and stuff already prior, right?
I don't think so. That was that label out of Lowell, Mass. Or, shit, I can't remember. Rykodisc.
Oh yeah, I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's my fault. Ryko Dist. That's right. I don't know why I said Matador. They redid so many other things that I get confused. But
Later
the
on, since then, Matador released that we released everything.
yeah, I got my little out of order there. So that whole period, like you guys got all of a sudden real. You're probably busier than you ever were from like 2004 to 2012, pretty much, right?
Irma wasn't, but I was.
Oh, you didn't. I mean, there were several Burma tours, though, right?
Yeah, but in back in like from 79 to 83, we played 7 gigs a month, and sometimes we'd go on 3 week tours. And when Burma Mach 2 reformed, we'd go for months without playing. And then we'd say, oh, we got shows. Then we'd start to rehearse and learn some new material, and then we'd be ready to rock. I mean, that was the thing that was said about the Reformation, as it were. It was that, look, we died a really weird death in 83, where there was no reason for it to stop, except that I couldn't, I said I wanted to still hear when I was 50. 2002, I could still hear, so let's rock. let's form the band. And dude, I lost my train of thought there, sorry.
It's all right. Were you surprised how popular the reunion became and how you guys were so well received?
Completely caught off guard. I just, when initially the idea was brought up, we literally thought we'd play one gig in New York and one gig in Boston. And it turned out to be two sold out shows at the Irving Plaza in New York, where and four, I think it was four, maybe it was only three sold out shows in Boston. Two at the Paradise and one at the, I don't even know what it was called at that point. Avalon, maybe. And or maybe three shows at Paradise. I can't remember. But yeah, it was like freaky. I just thought there'd be two shows and then I'd get back to doing what I normally do. And it was like, and then Shellac brought us. They said, well, after we played those first five shows, Boston and New York, Shellac said, well, why don't you come play Ultimo's parties in Southern England? We go, well, God, we never went to Europe back in the day. And then we all had one new song, and then we had more songs, and then we played like little jaunts in the West Coast, the Midwest, and pretty soon we were a band and we were recording a new album. But it was all very haphazard. There was very little planning.
It's funny. It seems like that it's it didn't, doesn't seem as long ago as it was, but Unsound came out in 2012. That's like over 10 years ago. Okay, I want to jump ahead here because I know you're really busy and you're working on a lot of things right now. And you've also there's been some things that have come out. Like I saw the Unfold recorded 92, 95. I'd never heard that before. And I saw that on Bandcamp and I listened to it and I was like, wow, this is wild. And I saw Rich Gilbert played on that, which I didn't know that either.
Yeah, he was. I mean, I wanted to get. It was called Roger Miller's X Was a Corpse, and X Was a Corpse, the Surrealist Game. Things that don't belong together, you put together. So I had a Renaissance instrument, rock instruments. Ken was playing ethnic percussion, non-Western, and I had a classical violinist, and then Rich Gilbert playing a pedal steel guitar. How much more absurd can you get? And then we put it together, and I mean, it was me putting it together. It was my vision, but everybody was great in the band. All the players were really excellent.
You're performing at the I think it's a really good festival, the Town and the City Festival. I saw that you're on the bill April 27th. What can we expect? What are you going to be doing for that at that festival?
I'm doing most of my touring now is based on my most recent album, Eight Dream Interpretations for Solo Electric Guitar Ensemble. I'm Cuneiform, where all the music is structured by dreams, and I'm playing four guitars, three lap steels on legs that are prepared, and a Strat around my neck. And then I have a looper that can have three completely different loops at different times, and a lot of foot pedals, a lot of them in stereo. So it's this kind of psychedelic, surrealist psychedelic sounds, but all organized by dreams. So that they're if you know anything about dreams, dreams are irrational because they're not conscious thought, but they have a very much a set of order to them. So the pieces, despite how peculiar they are in some ways, they all make sense in an alternate reality. And that's the music that I'm doing live. And it's at that show, and I'm doing it next week in Keene, and then I'm playing, opening up from Aesthetics in Boston at the Crystal Ballroom in May 18th. Yeah, I really want to go out and play that. When I've been playing it, the response has been freaky. Like, people say that one of my friends said she started tripping halfway through the set. And she didn't take anything. You know, it's because music really is from your unconscious. And to me, tripping is like dreaming in real time, like dreaming aloud. That's what tripping is to some degree. And the reviews have been just incredible. So I plan to keep this thing moving, and I'm working on a new album of it, this material.
That's fantastic. Do you listen to a lot of other music these days?
I'm staying somewhere while the construction is going on in our house, so we don't have a turntable. So I listen to a lot of stuff on turntable. I like Mini Beast a lot. That's Pete's band.
Yeah.
All their records. There's a band that's actually on the same night that I'm playing the Lowell Festival, Sapling. They're on after I am.
They're cool.
Incredible band. And I'm going to be sitting in with them on cornet, just like.
Really?
They asked me to do something. I said, anything you ask. I love the band is so unusual and so good also. Just like really exceptional players. And then I listen to anything from Bela Bartok to, Miles to current stuff to old stuff.
So is it all vinyl? Do you ever do any streaming?
I don't use Spotify, but I'll sometimes just shoot through YouTube and listen to stuff, look up some band that I like and just, God, I've never heard that Yardbirds version of Shapes of Things with Jimmy Page. It's not as good as the other one, but still, it's pretty funny to watch.
Hey, man, thanks a lot for coming on here. I appreciate you talking to me.
Well,
and
so.
I'm going to probably come to the town and the city festival. So you got me really curious now. I can't wait to see that.
It's unusual stuff, and it's not only highly unorthodox and different from anything that's come before, but as a lot of the reviews say, it's actually not that hard to listen to. Like, it's not like crazy avant-garde music that you don't want to listen to. It's crazy avant-garde music that you do like listening to. So anyways.
Looking forward to it. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much. Talk to you later.
Laugh the World Away, Mission of Burma. That was a bonus track on the reissued version of Versus, and I believe first appeared on the Ryko disc compilation, which came out in 1988. I flubbed that up in the interview, by the way, and said it was a Matador compilation, but no, it was definitely Ryko disc. I don't know why I said that, because I have the Ryko disc one. Great honor and pleasure talking with Roger Miller, one of the true innovators to emerge onto the American indie scene of the 80s. Man, the 80s was so great. And when it comes to independent releases, and then, you know, the majors came along and scooped everyone up and they messed it all up. I guess I may have contributed to that a little bit, not much, just a little, since I worked at a major label. But I love the independent releases of the 80s and talk about those forever. And we've had several people on the show now that were involved in many of those records, and we will have more. All right. If you want to reach out to me, you can anytime. You can write me at twistedrico@gmail.com. And if you're a musician or a songwriter and you have music, please send it. A lot of people do. And you might hear it here or maybe on the Mirror Stars podcast. We have an Instagram page, Facebook, Threads, YouTube, where you can watch the interview. You can watch it. That's right. The Zoom interview I did with Roger Miller. And there's also a TikTok page at Twisted Rico, where you can watch clips from the show and other groovy stuff. All right. Please consider supporting this podcast on our Patreon page, which is patreon.com/TwistedRico. All right, that's going to do it for this time. Till the next time we say goodbye, this is Blowing Smoke with Twisted Rico. I'm your host, Steve Ricardo. Keep the rock and roll alive.